Hello and welcome to The Europeans, your weekly fix of all things Europe served hot and fresh straight into your ear canals.
I don't want anything hot and fresh in my ear canals. This is another bad metaphor. You need to work on these, Dominic.
Thank you. I'm Dominic Kramer, coming to you from Amsterdam, and I'm talking to Katie Lee in Paris. Hi, Katie.
Hello. Something actually quite historic is happening this weekend, listeners. Dominic is actually coming to visit me.
It's true. And to my shame, I haven't visited her in many, many years, actually. So, and Katie's been here in Amsterdam many times.
Yeah, can I just say, the imbalance in visiting duties in this friendship is outrageous. I have been to visit you in Amsterdam approximately 5,000 times over the years. I think you have been here once?
Yeah, but until recently you didn't have a spare room, so there was nowhere to house me. So in my defense, yeah.
Yeah. You better bring me some stroopwafels to make up for it.
I will, don't worry.
How are things over there in Amsterdam, actually? Because they've been pretty tense, no?
Yeah, it's been a pretty weird and sad and scary few weeks here in Amsterdam since I last spoke to you on this podcast. And I'm sure lots of our listeners will have heard something about the chaos in this city that ensued around a football match between the Tel Aviv team Maccabi and the local Ajax team. Things are now much calmer, thankfully, but the past few weeks have brought like an incredibly depressing and toxic combination of misinformation, police violence, Islamophobia, and anti-Semitism in my city. Mm. And it's been quite destabilizing for lots of people living here. And yeah, as I said, scary. I'm still processing it all, to be honest, but the events have just made me like more worried than ever about polarization and how division can be deliberately harnessed by far-right politicians who want to further empower themselves. It's not something I didn't know about already, but it's quite something to witness that happening like close up in a place where you live. So yeah, it's not been an easy few weeks, honestly.
You mentioned something your husband said that really stuck with me, which is that he was worried about you going out because you look Jewish. I mean, this must have been very strange for you personally.
Yeah, I mean, it is strange, especially because I'm not Jewish. I mean, I have some Jewish heritage and I am descended from some Jewish people who were persecuted, but I didn't have a bar mitzvah. I've not been brought up in a Jewish family. But it was really weird to hear my husband not wanting me to leave the house because he thought I might be in danger. I mean, as it turns out, I think the danger to me was overstated by the media. It wasn't as huge an anti-Semitic attack as it was made out to be. There were horrible anti-Semitic events, but the Amsterdam mayor herself has now said that she was wrong to use the term pogrom and to refer to those awful events in history. And of course, there are people who are suffering from this much more than me, actual Jewish people, and also the Arabic community, who have also felt very unsafe and threatened in the past few weeks. So, yeah, I don't want to make this about myself, but it was a weird moment indeed. But actually, it's not what we're going to be talking about this week, because there's so many things happening in Europe, as always, right?
Yeah. What have we got coming up this week?
Today, we're going to be talking about the Iranian government's attempts to silence dissidents abroad. It's a practice known as transnational repression, which is a form of political oppression where a state threatens, kidnaps, or even kills its citizens living abroad or in exile. And it's happening rather terrifyingly here in Europe. The Afghan-American journalist Fariba Nawa will be joining us from Turkey later on in this show to talk about exactly what she uncovered in her reporting for an incredible 9-part podcast series called Lethal Dissent, which looked into the price and peril that Iranians abroad can face for seeking to speak out against their government. That's coming up later, but first, it's time for Good Week, Bad Week.
Who has had a good week, Dominic?
I'm going to give Denmark the honour of good week after the Danish government announced a deal to convert 10% of Danish farmland into forest and natural habitats.
That's a lot of land.
It really is. They're going to plant 1 billion trees, create 5 new national parks, and to do all this, they're spending around 43 billion Danish kroner, which is almost 5.75 billion euros.
Wowza.
The government said, Danish nature will change in a way that we have not seen since the wetlands were drained in 1864. And this is all on top of an incredibly exciting world-first tax on emissions from livestock, which was also part of this deal.
This sounds like actual good news for this Good Week segment for once. Like, this isn't actually going to turn out to be one of those heavily caveated Good Weeks that's mostly bad news, is it?
Well, of course, there are some criticisms of the bill. We'll come to that later. But it is a glimmer of hope amidst all this gloom of recent times.
So you said they're going to be spending how many billions?
5.75 billion euros, or the equivalent in krona.
That's a lot of krona. And what is that money going to be spent on specifically?
A lot of that will be spent on buying up farmland off farmers and investing in agricultural innovations for other farmers. But it's also there to pay for the planting of the trees and a wide range of other nature restoration projects. I mentioned that 10% of the farmland is going to be turned into natural land. Mm-hmm. But to make you realize how big a deal that is, you need to know how much of Denmark's land is covered by agriculture. And it's around two-thirds of Denmark's land which currently has agriculture on it.
What?
Yeah, so a 10% reduction of that is quite huge and is really going to transform Denmark's landscape.
Wow.
The deal also sets goals for reducing nitrogen emissions. By 2027, they need to cut nitrogen emissions by about a quarter compared to if no measures were taken. There is also expected to be a big drop in methane emissions once this innovative livestock tax comes into force. So it's all very exciting.
It is really rare in this day and age that legislation like this actually gets passed. How did they manage to pull this off politically?
Well, I should mention that the bill hasn't actually passed Parliament yet.
Okay.
This week was just the announcement of the deal, but the passing of these bills in Parliament is apparently pretty much a given, as it's got such broad political support. Firstly, from the three governing parties, the Social Democrats, the Liberals and the Moderates, but also from the Green Left, the Conservatives, Liberal Alliance and the Social Liberal Party. Hmm. The deal has been a long time in the making, and in order to make it, they brought together agricultural organizations, environmental organizations, and politicians all together to try and find solutions for this unsustainable level of agriculture. And I guess the fact that all these different stakeholders were brought together is why it now has such broad support across the political spectrum. And I guess it also makes it more likely that these changes, these big changes, will be accepted by society and, crucially, by farmers. Of course, not everyone is happy with it, as I hinted at. And one party on the left actually dropped out of negotiations for the deal right at the last minute, just a few days before the deal was announced. They say it doesn't go far enough. And for example, they think the taxes aren't set at a high enough level. They also criticize the provisions in the deal to restore the quality of Denmark's water and seabeds. They think they don't go far enough. Denmark's seabeds are in a pretty terrible state, largely due to the discharge of nitrogen into the water from agriculture. That's one of the reasons why the nitrogen levels really need to decrease. The deal does try to address this problem, but I have to say I am inclined to believe these critics on the left who say the bill isn't going far enough. And yeah, I'm sure the deal is imperfect, and I really hope the critics can persuade the government to strengthen the environmental provisions. But honestly, right now, I also just need a win, even if it's not a total win. And it clearly is progress.
Yeah.
And seeing a country that is actually able to get its shit together and sort out any kind of policy that will restore some nature and limit emissions from farming is, at this time, inspiring. And I hope that it will inspire other countries to do something similar. Where I live in the Netherlands, there have been ongoing negotiations and debates for years now about what to do with our unsustainable levels of agriculture and the emissions, particularly the illegally high levels of nitrogen that come from that. I don't have much hope that the Dutch government, led by a far-right party and backed up by a populist farmers' party, are going to follow Denmark as an example, but I hope it at least shifts the debate a bit and shows politicians all across Europe that some things can be done and the public can be brought along if you show leadership and bring all these different stakeholders together.
Sorry to burst this bright, hopeful bubble of yours, but if you zoom out a bit and look at Europe, yes, this has been quite a nice week for news about planting trees in Denmark, but for the EU as a whole, they've got this deforestation bill going through Parliament right now, and there was pretty grim news for that this week, no?
Yeah, thanks for bringing us back down to earth, Katie.
Welcome.
The EU's landmark deforestation bill, that's a bill that aims to block products that come from deforested land from being sold in the EU. And yeah, indeed, that was due to come into force at the end of this year, but the Parliament this week agreed to the Commission's proposal to delay implementation, and they also diluted it down with further amendments. So yeah, it's not all excellent news, but that bill is still going to do something, and it's really necessary because according to the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, EU consumption is responsible for about 10% of all global deforestation, which I was quite shocked by.
Yeah, me too.
But hey, I'm in a mood of accentuating the positive today, so I'm giving good week to Denmark.
Stay in Denmark, stay in Denmark.
Who's had a bad week, Katie?
Well, it hasn't been a great week if you are part of the Hungarian minority living in Slovakia, because the populist government of Prime Minister Robert Fico is proposing a legal change that would ban the Hungarian language and other minority languages in Slovakia from being used in announcements on public transport, for example. So if you are, you know, a train conductor going through a Hungarian-speaking area, you would be breaking the law if you addressed your passengers in Hungarian, even if that's what everyone in that area speaks. The Slovak language would also have to appear first in adverts on restaurant menus and public signs, regardless of where you are in the country. Street signs specifically potentially present quite a big practical problem, because often the Slovak names for places, the words don't have any resemblance to the Hungarian names for that same place. So that could be really confusing for getting around in places where people tend to use the Hungarian names. And any breaches to this law would be punishable with fines of up to 15,000 euros. Your restaurant could be fined, for example, over menu items that aren't written in Slovak first. But overall, this does seem to be quite a linguistic crackdown and an effort by the Slovak government to say quite loudly, you know, in this country, there is one language that comes first, and it's Slovak.
It sounds like a totally useless bill. Why would a politician want to do this? It's depressing. How many people in Slovakia actually speak Hungarian?
Quite a lot. So just for listeners who are maybe less familiar with this part of Europe, Hungary's modern borders don't match up super well with the communities that speak the language. There are sizable Hungarian-speaking minorities in a bunch of countries in Central and Eastern Europe, including Romania and Ukraine. In Slovakia, the last census suggests that about 8% of the population speak Hungarian as a native language. It is the country's biggest minority. And these communities are concentrated mostly in the south of Slovakia, close to the border with Hungary. It's not the only minority language spoken in Slovakia. There are also pockets where a majority speak Romani or Rusyn. But yeah, it is the biggest one. And this big Hungarian community means that the government in Hungary, the country next door, they take a lot of interest in what happens to this community. This runs pretty deep. You can kind of trace this back to this 1920 international treaty called the Treaty of Trianon, in which Hungary lost a ton of territory. And it's still this extremely sore point for Hungarian nationalists, like the ruling party Fidesz, who feel this great sense of injustice that modern Hungary isn't bigger.
I'm assuming that the treatment of this Hungarian minority in Slovakia is something that sometimes causes friction between these two governments then?
Yeah, it's been a source of friction for a really long time. Slovakia is a very young country. It's existed since 1993. And in the 90s, when it was just starting to assert itself as a nation, you saw Slovak nationalists starting to say extremely ugly things about the Hungarian minority. Jan Slota of the far-right SNS party, for example, he infamously described Hungarians as a tumor in the body of the Slovak nation that should be removed. His party, it should be noted, are now in government as part of Robert Fico's coalition. And when we're talking about the use of the Hungarian language in particular, there was quite a bitter row between the two countries over a legal amendment, quite similar to this one, back in 2009. It was a law that made Slovak the mandatory language of all public services. So it became mandatory for teachers to speak Slovak, for doctors and so on. There were some practical opt-outs in the end. So, you know, if you were a doctor working in a predominantly Hungarian-speaking area, you would be allowed to speak to your patients in Hungarian. But this helped to fuel a quite bitter diplomatic row around 2009 over a range of different things. However, lately, as far as the leaders of these two countries are concerned, Viktor Orban and Robert Fico have been quite chummy since Fico got into power last year. They have quite a similar outlook on the world. Yeah. They are both admirers of Vladimir Putin. They both think Europe is helping Ukraine too much. They both hate migrants. In a lot of ways, they see eye to eye. And they're part of this increasingly powerful group of nationalist leaders in Europe, along with people like Meloni in Italy, who are holding more sway across this continent. But some people are wondering whether the budding bromance between Orban and Fico might come to a sticky end over this language law. You've got two neighboring populist governments who both have an interest in taking a tough position on this to appeal to their respective nationalist voter bases.
Yeah, it's that problem that we've talked about before on this podcast about European political leaders on the ultra-nationalist far right wanting to work together, that essentially they are all ultra-nationalists. So
it's hard to be that friendly.
Yeah, it's hard to collaborate in that case.
Poor things.
But Katie, did you get a sense of why the Slovak government is actually trying to pass this law? Like, is it purely because it's something that plays well with their nationalist base? Or is there actually a kind of practical justification for it?
Well, the government has said that it's not at all about attacking Hungarian speakers or any other minority. It is about clarifying the law. So the one passed back in 2009 is actually quite a weird, vague law. Supposedly, you can be punished under that existing law for improper use of the Slovak language, but it's really unclear what that means. So they want to clarify it. But it does seem like this update, if it passes, would make controls over language significantly stricter in Slovakia. Certainly, there would be way bigger fines for breaking the law, 20 times as big as the current fines. So it doesn't seem to be just about clarifying the situation. It is worth noting that this amendment is being pushed by the culture minister, Martina Šimkovičová. She's a member of the smaller ultra-nationalist party in Fico's coalition that I mentioned, the SNS. I actually name-checked this minister on the podcast just a few weeks ago because she is the person who has been leading this quite disturbing cultural crackdown in Slovakia. Remember, she fired the head of the National Theatre, the National Gallery, the National Library.
Yeah.
She was trying to get the public broadcaster to be put under state control. She has said that this law is about protecting the Slovak language, which is a familiar talking point for nationalists in lots of countries, including here in France, for example. You know, Le Pen often bangs on about the need to protect the French language from foreign influences, including the creep of English words into French daily life. And this policy does seem to be aimed very much at hard-right Slovakian voters. There doesn't seem to be any real threat to the Slovak language that really needs addressing here. I was actually chatting about all of this to one of our listeners, Arnold, who is a member of the Hungarian minority in Slovakia. He grew up in the 90s amidst some of the ugliest anti-Hungarian rhetoric. He has witnessed this firsthand. And he described bullying minorities as a classic Slovak nationalist move. He also said, though, that we shouldn't take it as a given that this legal change will pass. He mentioned that the culture minister, yes, she has been doing a bunch of crazy stuff within her direct powers. But when it comes to actually getting the whole of parliament to vote through legal changes, her ability to behave like a loose cannon is much more limited. So we will see. Arnold said, it has been a bad week for the Hungarian minority in Slovakia, but not in an obvious way, but rather a sad one. It's just another election cycle in which we get kicked around for the benefit of someone's nationalist vote. I don't know. I mean, I think generally in Europe, we've got better in recent decades at understanding why it's important to protect smaller languages. We have literally centuries of history on this continent of suppressing languages, from Catalan to Irish to the Sami languages. And then there's everything the Soviet Union did, for example, to try and make the countries under its influence conform linguistically. This kind of policy almost always comes from a place of insecurity. And very often, if the idea is to make people conform and become less rebellious, it doesn't work because people are proud of their identity and language is part of that identity. There have been arguments made in the past for using crackdowns on the use of minority languages as something that is necessary to help build a nation in unstable times. And if you think about something like Esperanto, I mean, the idea behind that is that if we all share a language, it'll bring us together and that linguistic unity is a good thing. But there are, of course, also many, many examples of governments trying to stamp out the use of minority languages as a form of cultural repression. And I don't know. I mean, obviously, Slovakia is not the only place where people speak Hungarian. But according to the EU's Academy website, the number of people speaking this language has dropped by 1 million in the past 25 years. So it is something that should be protected where it is used. And even if you put aside the idea that it is morally wrong to bring in policies that deliberately make it harder for people to use their languages and to express themselves in whatever languages they want, it is just a loss for all of us when smaller languages start fading away. You know, languages are ways of thinking. They contain so much richness in terms of different metaphors that they contain, the different senses of humor that they contain. So personally, I think these tired old nationalist arguments about the need to protect the Slovak language or to protect French or whatever majority language is spoken in that place, I do think we need to fight them whenever we can.
Agreed.
Listeners, if you heard the special announcement episode that dropped a week ago, you'll know that we are cooking up something very exciting for 2025, a new series called Who Does It Best. It is going to be 100% crowdfunded, and we cannot believe how amazing the response has been so far. We've raised a third of the funding needed in just a few days. Can you believe it, Dominic?
Yeah, it's really amazing and heartwarming, and it's totally made my past week that people have been so generous already. So thank you so much. But we also actually have quite a long way to go.
Yes.
And I feel like the beginning is the easiest bit. Like, people are enthusiastic at the beginning and now we need more people to donate. Otherwise, it's not actually going to be able to be made, this series, which we really want to make.
We do. We're incredibly excited about it. So if you haven't heard that episode yet and you are intrigued by what we're talking about, check out the episode just before this one. We are so happy and so surprised at how far we are along the way to making this happen already. But as Dominic says, we still need to keep up the momentum. But another good thing that happened this week that we really weren't expecting is that so many people decided, you know what, I'm not just going to send the Europeans a one-off donation to crowdfund this new series. I'm also going to sign up separately to send money their way each week via Patreon to support the general running of the show. So nice of people.
Yeah, it was really amazing and quite surprising, actually, how many people joined Patreon over the last 2 weeks. So thank you, everyone. We have an extraordinary number of people to give a quick shout out to now. I'm going to try and do it all in one breath, but I don't know if I'll make it this week.
Oof.
Thank you to Michelle, Fabienne, Dorothea, Andrew, Wadim, Sorin, Ray, Javi, Chris, Luke, Jean-Pierre, Jessica, Leonard, Charlie, Danny, Lola, Moicha, Niels, Tim, Luigi, Vicky, Jason, Clovis, Stephen, Sheridan, Teresa, Lord Harriment, and also to Thorsten for increasing. Thank you all.
That is so impressive. Did you take a sneaky breath in there that I just couldn't hear from over here in Paris?
I did take a breath before Thorsten,
naughty.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
We'll let you get away with it this time. Thank you so, so, so much, everyone. You will find links to both the crowdfunder for our new series, Who Does It Best, and also for our Patreon page if you fancy supporting our work. Every now and then, a news story comes along that reminds me just how insignificant borders can be. These lines on the map, they shape our lives in all kinds of ways. Like, they might decide who gets one set of rights and who gets barely any rights. People risk their lives trying to cross them. And then every so often, there's a story in the news about someone who has fled across a border, or maybe several borders, fleeing from an authoritarian government that sees them as a threat. Maybe it's because they're a defector or a dissident or a rights activist. And then it becomes very clear that actually getting out of the country doesn't necessarily make that person any safer. In February, for example, a very well-known Russian army defector named Maxim Kuzminov was gunned down in Spain. Leonid Volkov, who used to work for the late Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, he got attacked in the street in Lithuania with a hammer. Russia, specifically, has shown over and over again that its enemies aren't safe just because they managed to make it to the European Union or elsewhere. But they're not the only terrifying government that targets its dissidents abroad. Iran also has a well-documented track record of doing this. But I have to say that Iran's threats and assassination attempts abroad, I wasn't nearly so familiar with that as I was with Russia doing this kind of thing. That is until recently when I listened to a fascinating podcast series. The series is called Lethal Dissent. It's by the excellent team at OnSpec, the slow journalism podcast. And if you like podcasts like Serial, I think you'll find this very, very gripping listening. It's a very well-investigated podcast about just this phenomenon. Iran's hunting down of its citizens who have fled abroad in search of safety. We phoned up the lead reporter for this series, the incredibly badass Afghan-American journalist, Fariba Banawa.
Fariba, thank you so much for joining us today. I wanted to start by heartily congratulating you for producing such a deeply reported and hard-hitting story. It's really an amazing investigation with some incredible scoops. And I wondered whether you could first start by telling us why you decided to pursue this story in the first place.
Well, I'm from Afghanistan, and as you know, the Taliban took over, and they're doing similar things to women, or much, much worse than the Iranian government is. And so it all started with the Women, Life, Freedom movement, and I felt very close to it when it started in late September 2022, the protests began in Iran. And I started to cover the protests. And then I realized that there were a lot of Iranian dissidents in Turkey and that they were afraid. When I would go to the protests, they would hide their faces and they didn't trust anyone. And then I started to understand how dire the situation was for Iranian dissidents in Turkey. And so that's how it started. And I speak the language. We speak the same language in Afghanistan and Iran. It's just a different dialect. So that gave me an in with the community here. But it was very hard to gain trust because very few people trust each other because you could be a regime informant. And I was often accused of that.
This story revolves around something called transnational repression. Could you explain what that means?
Transnational repression is a fancy word for any government trying to kidnap and kill and hurt its own dissidents across borders. More and more countries seem to be engaging in this tactic.
And when we're talking about Iran specifically, what kind of threats do Iranian dissidents face in countries where they're seeking refuge?
Renditions. They kidnap them and bring them back to Iran, put them on trials. Usually they're not fair trials, and execute them for crimes that they're accused of in Iran. Interestingly enough, also assassinations. Who the regime decides to assassinate and who they decide to kidnap is an interesting question that I haven't fully been able to answer. But those are the extreme cases. Usually it's online harassment. Mm-hmm. It's knocking on your door saying, we're going to come and get you if you don't stop speaking out. Journalists, military defectors, former politicians, businessmen who have influence inside Iran, these are the people they usually target. Average protesters, they generally don't have time for, but if they start to get well known, they'll go after their families in Iran and try to stop them. Mostly, it seems the people that they want to kidnap and kill are people who are previously on the inside, meaning part of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps or part of the government. They get very nervous about military defectors.
Why?
Because they have inside information. And Iran has invested millions in trainings, you know, especially if they're specialized, like the Navy captain that we talk about in Lethal Dissent. So they come after them, not only to punish them for what they did, but also to scare others into not leaving as well, into basically fear-mongering, saying, look what we did to so-and-so, we're going to do the same thing to you. Mm. Don't you think about leaving. You're going to be punished.
So your reporting focuses on this phenomenon of transnational repression happening in Turkey, but it is something that we have documented cases of in other European countries as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So the latest case that involved violence was the case of journalist Puria Zarawati in London. He was stabbed in front of his house. Nothing was stolen from him. So obviously it wasn't a robbery. It was a warning from the regime for him not to express anti-regime opinions on his show on Iran International. The Islamic Republic dislikes Iran International because Iran International is fiercely against them. Sometimes the information coming out of Iran International is not always accurate, but mostly they don't believe journalists should be saying anything against them. And Iran International has quite a bit of influence inside Iran. Both BBC Farsi and Iran International, the journalists have been told to be careful, have been put under police protection. They've been targeted. They've had to move their buildings to undisclosed locations because of this, specifically Iran International. One of the women that I'm writing about right now is in France. She's under police protection. She keeps getting calls on her phone from the regime telling her that they're going to attack her family if she doesn't stop talking to the press. Mm. She's a women's rights activist, but she is talking to all of the Farsi-speaking opposition media on a regular basis. And so she gets threats on a regular basis, and she keeps sending them to me, the online threats. She was targeted here in Turkey. She was walking to the corner market when she was here, and a sedan stopped with several men inside. One of them came out and started yelling at her in Farsi, saying, "If you don't stop talking to the Persian media, we're going to come after you. We're going to throw you in the trunk of the car and take you across the border, and we're going to take your sister." Her sister has been sentenced and has spent quite a lot of time in the notorious Evin prison inside Iran. And she's in hiding right now, her sister. So this family is constantly in danger, but they're used to it. I mean, it's almost like accepted that this is part of life for you if you're Iranian, no matter where you go.
It's absolutely horrifying. And I you say the case in London got quite a lot of attention. And yeah, I did see it reported on, but I'm surprised that this is something that not everyone knows about. I mean, when a Russian dissident is killed on European soil, I feel like it gets so much more attention. And some of these stories of Iranian dissidents being threatened and killed seem to be going under the radar a bit. Do you have any theory as to why that is?
Maybe because it happens quite often. Assassinations are rare. Let me clarify that. In Turkey, there have been two assassinations in the last several years. One was a cybersecurity expert who was working in their inner circle, and he was assassinated, and it was very clear. An Iranian diplomat was convicted of murder and then allowed to leave. That's the other thing, is that there seems to be complete impunity. Iran is very good at getting away with it. I think the other reason is because Russia gets more attention because of the war in Ukraine. You have an ongoing war. And this is about Iranians against their own people. So I'm not sure that it is as sexy of a topic as the Russian one right now. But yeah, it happens. It's happened since 1979. But since 2022, we're seeing an uptick since the protests, especially against women dissidents.
At some point, reporting on this story became dangerous for you. Did you consider the risks when you first decided to start reporting on this story? Like, had people warned you about getting into this topic?
Yes, yes. The Iranians themselves would just look at me and say, "Do you know what you're doing? Do you know how many of our journalists are in jail now?" You know, the journalist that started reporting on the Mahsa Amini, the woman who was killed in the custody of the regime that prompted the protests, the woman life protests, those journalists ended up going to prison. They were like, "Don't mess with the Iranian regime." I took calculated risks. I always traveled with colleagues. We would use WhatsApp and Telegram and these things. I know they're not absolutely safe, but we deleted messages when we could. We saved messages when we could. Also, we followed a trail of documents so that if anything did happen, and we had a group chat among the team so that everyone knew where everybody was, and there was constant communication between us. But as you said, it did get dicey, so I don't reveal my location in Turkey. And I don't post that much about my children or where we are or what we're doing. I have a guard in front of our apartment. I mean, the apartment guard, they know what's going on. They're very careful about who they let in and out of my apartment. My children are not allowed to be out by themselves after dark. Our life has become limited as a result, and that's not fun. But it is something that I had to do. Once I started it, there was no ending it until the story was done.
Wow. Well, thank you for doing that for us all. I mean, it sounds like a really difficult thing for you and your family to have to go through, but you did uncover some pretty staggering scoops. I mean, the kind that many investigative journalists only dream of. Did these revelations have any impact on helping any of the protagonists of your story?
Yeah, I mean, this is why I think I kept going, is these folks are registered as refugees in Turkey, and Turkey's sort of the transition country because Turkey doesn't accept refugees, does not give them asylum. It gives them protection through the UN mandate. So they wait for years in limbo, sometimes up to 10 years to get asylum to a third country. Most of the folks that we wrote about were already refugees here, and we were able to get three people, help them get asylum to the West. Like I said, one who is in France is still facing threats, but at least we know she's being looked after by French authorities and she's gotten asylum. But one gentleman, the Navy captain in the story, is still here and very afraid of what's going to happen once President Trump takes over, because he's been approved for asylum, but he hasn't been evacuated yet. Another gentleman, Mehdi Hajati, who was in the first part of the series, he's been evacuated already. He was the most urgent case, and he was out of here as soon as it was possible for him to be. He went on a special visa. So yeah, we made an impact individually. And that's a big deal. I mean, that's not the danger of dissidents thinking that if they get their stories out, they'll get to safety. That doesn't always happen. These were specific cases where these people should have been out of here already. Us doing the story just gave them that edge. Anything more than that, the Turkish government wouldn't even talk to us. So we decided to go through a parliamentarian who made it public. And I saw that Turkish government officials started following me on Twitter after the story came out. And that was interesting because, you know, I'm not a very high profile journalist here. I try not to be anyway.
Yeah, I can imagine.
It's nice to speak to someone else who's part of a podcast team that's like relatively small and doing things for less money than they should be doing. I've heard you say somewhere that you feel like you made this story, which should be a $100,000 story, on a $30,000 budget. And I wonder, how do you think this affected the reporting process? And does it feel sustainable for you?
No, it's not sustainable. I can't afford it, literally, to do that again. A lot of people worked for very, very little money because they cared about this. It's appalling. No country should be doing this to people who are asking for very basic freedoms. And I think my team was like, okay, now that we've started it, we can't stop because there's not enough money. We're just going to work for free or for very little money. It was not something we had planned to do, but that's what happened. And also, we started out with four episodes, and the story just got bigger. We just kept finding stuff. Every rock I would turn over, I was finding new evidence and new pieces and new clues. So it was very exciting to work on it. As a reporter, it was just like, oh my God, I love this. You know, again, it was the passion of for the work as well.
Well, congratulations again. You've done a fantastic job. I really recommend this series, and I hope that lots of our listeners will check it out. Faruba's series is called Lethal Descent. You can find it wherever you're listening to this, and I really recommend that you do. It is an incredible piece of reporting. And actually, speaking of great pieces of reporting about transnational repression, we've talked about Iran, we talked a little bit about Russia. I can't talk about this topic without also mentioning China,
yeah,
which goes to great lengths to hunt down its own citizens who've been trying to escape its reach. There's an excellent piece that came out not so long ago in New York Times Magazine that one of our listeners, Britta, shared with us last week. It's an incredibly detailed account of one man from China's Uyghur minority trying to flee the horrific repression that the Chinese state has been inflicting on millions of people from this ethnic group, only to find that being abroad doesn't actually make them safe. In China's case, partly because so many of the countries that Uyghurs flee to are desperate to win Chinese business. It's a really interesting, if very, very grim read. You'll find a link to that in the show notes, along, of course, with a link to the podcast series that you've just heard about, Lethal Dissent. It's time to head to the Inspiration Station. We're chugging in. Dominic, what have you got for us this week?
Well, I've been watching a lot of documentaries lately. It's been my way of processing the kind of post-US election sadness. And I've been just sitting crying, watching loads of moving documentaries.
What an image.
Yeah, but most of them are not available widely. So I'm actually not going to talk about them yet. And instead, I wanted to talk about my latest online addiction, which also is in part an addiction because of the Trump victory in the US. It's Blue Sky.
Blue Sky. Oh.
Now, I was skeptical that this Twitter alternative was ever going to take off, that like a critical mass of people would ever all decide to move away from X. But it is happening. I imagine a lot of you are there already because, yeah, Blue Sky has seen its membership numbers explode over the past few weeks as people leave X in droves, largely because they don't want to be hanging out on a social media site that is becoming more and more toxic and is run by Trump's BFF. The richest man baby in the world, Elon Musk. If you haven't made the switch yet and are still hanging out on X, thinking it's going to be hard to build up your following again, I want to convince you today to take the plunge. Like, don't wait any longer. Do it today. Yes, you do have to build up your following again, but everyone is in the same boat. And I've noticed that follower numbers are increasing surprisingly quickly because there are so many new people arriving every day looking for people to follow. And because there's a really nice positive vibe of generosity on this site and people are really engaging, responding, liking each other's posts. We're actually on Blue Sky with the podcast at europeanspod.bsky.social. And we have about a tenth of the number of followers we have on X, but we get about 10 times more engagement from anything we post on Blue Sky than we do on X. And it made me realize that X has actually been dead for a long time.
Just because there's been no one there to talk to.
There's been no one there to talk to. And also the algorithms have been adjusted to a way that only if you say something really extreme and controversial does it get promoted by the algorithm.
And you're saying we haven't been doing that on the Europeans' Twitter feed?
Well, not enough. So yeah, head to Blue Sky, say goodbye to Elon Musk. It will make you feel good and you'll have more interesting discussions with people there. So that's my inspiration for the day.
Well, I'm glad you seem to have found your spiritual social media at home. I guess I'm still a little bit skeptical of it. I just set up an account and so far it seems to be like 90% people saying, isn't this nice? Rather than just like tweeting actual things, which is what I want to hear. Like, rather than talking about how nice it is, I want people to actually start posting the stuff, but I'm sure that will happen soon. Just a quick note to say, I'm also going to keep on Mastodon running because it's nice there too.
Oh, and before I forget, there's an extension that you can put on your browser called Sky Follower Bridge. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. And if you install that extension, then it helps you find people you followed or who followed you on X, formerly Twitter, who now have new accounts on Blue Sky.
Uh-huh.
So that's
handy.
A really handy way to, yeah, keep some of the community you used to have on the other site.
Well, I'm very happy to see it taking off.
Me too. What have you been enjoying, Katie?
I've got a nice little documentary to add to your list.
Will it make me cry?
No, I don't think it will make you cry because it's about metro trains, which is just nice and pleasing. It's from the European TV platform Arte, and it's about the metro system in Prague. It was recommended by Daniel on Mastodon. And it was one of those things where you sit down and you think, I'll just watch a few minutes of this. And then you end up watching the whole thing because you're just having a nice time. I've actually never been to Prague, scandalously. I am aiming to rectify this. But the city metro just looks so nice and pleasant and clean and well-designed in this documentary.
I went to Prague at the beginning of the year and I didn't even check it out. What an idiot I feel like now.
You missed out. I mean, I think it looks especially calm and clean to me because the Paris metro while functional, is somewhat chaotic and grubby, and usually there's like a human turd on the floor or something. Anyway, this nice little documentary is a kind of snapshot of a bunch of people who use the Prague Metro, work on the Metro, in a couple of cases are obsessed with the Metro, and I just found it nice to watch. It is on Arte, which I think, unfortunately, in this case at least, means that you can only get the audio in German or French, and I couldn't seem to get it subtitled in any other language.
Oh.
But if you speak German or French, or if you're learning one of those languages, you might like this. It's called Metro Cosmos, and it is on Arte.
Maybe it'll make me cry because I realize how bad my German is.
Add it to the list.
Time for a happy ending, and it's the third week in November, so we all know what that means, don't we? It's International Fraud Awareness Week.
Of course it is. Thank you for the reminder.
And I've got a totally charming and cheering news story about revenge against nasty telephone fraudsters that I wanted to share with you this week.
I'm into this.
Some clever people at the phone giant O2 have created an AI grandma called Daisy, who's been tricking telephone scammers into staying on the line for up to 40 minutes. The idea is that if scammers are talking to a fake AI-generated grandma, then it means wasted time for that scammer.
Yes!
Who would otherwise be scamming a real human being?
Love this! Great initiative.
It's one of those rare stories when AI seems to be being used in a genuinely uplifting way that's for the good of society.
So what kind of things does Grandma Daisy talk to the scammers about?
Apparently Daisy tells anecdotes that are way too long. She talks about her struggles with technology.
It's showing me a picture of my cat Fluffy.
It's showing you a picture of your cat Fluffy.
Stop calling me dear, you stupid.
Got it, dear.
And she also even offers her totally made up bank details to the scammer. O2 claims that this project has not only frustrated wannabe scammers, but has also helped their specialists work out exactly what the latest tactics are that scammers are using at the moment so that they can come up with better methods to prevent the fraud. Anyway, this is a reminder to us all to stay vigilant against telephone scammers and to realize that the person who we're speaking to on the other end of the line might not be who we think they are. It could be a scammer or it could be an AI grandma.
That's it for this week, but you can find us on
Blue Sky at europeanspod.bsky.social.
We're also on Mastodon, Ever Loyal, Instagram, and we're sticking around on Threads for now, though I don't think it's going to take off.
No.
Blue Sky's taking over.
Yeah, there are reports that political content is being downgraded in the Threads algorithm, so I have a feeling it's not the place for us.
But if you're on any of those other platforms, come and hang out with us there. And if you have a great idea for our series, Who Does It Best, drop us an email. We've got some great leads in already. hello@europeanspodcast.com.
This week's episode was produced by Morgan Childs and Wojciech Oleksiak. Thank you both. I better go and pack my bag, Katie.
Pack your stroop waffles.
Oh yeah, I better go and buy some stroop waffles.
I'll see you tomorrow and we'll see everyone else next Thursday. Have a great week, everyone.
Bye.
Peace, lads.